is The Talking Dead, a podcast dedicated to the AMC TV show The Walking Dead.
Hi everyone, my name is Chris.
And my name is Jason.
And this is The Talking Dead number 602, recorded on Tuesday, October the 18th, 2022. I love it, Jason, when we move the day of the podcast at the last minute and I don't update my notes. So the notes say Monday, but actually it's Tuesday and I had to pivot in real time there.
Well, you are a pivoter. You're pivoting on the pivot.
All of those things, I guess. So yeah, it's Tuesday. We're a day later than usual. It's because I got sick on this weekend that just passed, and I just did not feel up for it last night. So I tried to, I spoke to Jason. I said, look, dude, I'm sick. I can't record tonight. How about we do it tomorrow? And he said, no fucking way.
Yeah, fuck you. What's the matter with you?
Right, exactly. Get your shit together and sit in front of the mic. And I said, if I do that, I think I might die. And then he finally relented. So here we are on a Tuesday night after a good night's sleep last night. Although I woke up this morning feeling like, 10 pounds of garbage in a 5-pound bag. But as the day went on, I've gotten a little bit better. And I couldn't let the podcast go more than one night late. So here we are.
Yeah, it was the crying that got me in the end. when you started crying, I was like, okay, something's going on there. I relented after the crying. And the other thing is, if you feel like 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag and you woke up that way, yeah, you really need to change your sheets. And just a suggestion. I mean, I don't know about your lifestyle and how you like to sleep and everything, but that's my recommendation.
I think that's very, very important because there's just going to be shit everywhere.
And it's just oozed shit. Like, it's not just, like you shit the bed or anything, because that's, could be like, all kinds of piles of, I'm not going to, Amber Heard. Anyway, you need to change your sheets.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind. But I am feeling a little bit better every day. I feel a little bit better. I've been sick since kind of Saturday afternoon, I think. And here we are. But the podcast must go on, so on we go.
Onward we go.
We are here, of course, to talk about the latest episode of The Walking Dead. It's episode 19. So, Jason, I think we should just jump right in.
Surely.
Very ant. Very, very, very ant. Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry. Variant. Variant.
Season 11, episode 19, Variant. This episode ought to be very interesting. Thanks, guys.
And have a good one.
Thank you so much, Scott in Pasadena, and Grace and Ethan just down the road in Cobourg, Ontario.
Cobourg!
Good old Cobourg, yeah. The title reads lately have started to become puns, and I love it.
Yeah, it's all good.
Or puns, plays on words. I think those are the same thing. So very, very nice. And it will prove to be very interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Good stuff. Thanks, you guys. Okay, let's begin once again, Jason. We start with Judith doing her usual voiceover. I am more and more convinced we're going to get one of these for every one of the final 8 episodes.
Uh-huh.
This one is about Eugene mostly, and we see old clips of him and Rosita and Abraham when they were joining the group way back in the day. And Judith acknowledges that they've all done bad things, things they'd like to forget, but the choices they make now maybe are the ones that matter.
And we saw Glenn.
Yeah, we saw Glenn. I don't think that's the first time we've seen Glenn in one of these little sort of flashback montages, but it is a fun kind of look back reminder at those we've lost and events of days past. So
days gone by.
I like them. I don't mind it. I like how her quick little voiceovers kind of play into the text of the episode that's upcoming. And it's nice to hear Judith's voice, even when she's not in the episode.
Yeah. Do you think Steven Yeun gets a check when he appears on screen? Or is that part of the deal, was that, if we use your footage in future episodes, you don't get shit?
You know, who knows? But you know, I'm sure his likeness is contracted to this show until the end of time. So I don't know. I mean, in syndication, do the actors get checks every time plays somewhere?
That depends. I mean, Bob Denver never got one. Tina Louise never got one. Don Wells never got one. Specifically talking about Gilligan's Island.
Okay.
Because I know the actors on that show, they famously didn't sign syndication rights deals, so they didn't get jack shit after the show ended. And they were all like super typecast. So,
well, I mean, that sucks for them.
It does suck for them, like pretty hard. And back in the 70s and 80s, here we go for here's your television history lesson for the day, Chris. Since we're talking about syndication,
thank you.
Once you appeared in a show, basically you were blacklisted for anything. Like everybody, just all the casting directors and producers and such just ignored you. Forget it. You've been on a television show. We're not even giving you a chance. Whereas nowadays, they tend to give you a chance and they'll see what you can do. And
right.
Usually the first role after a television show is the exact same character you were playing in that TV show. And then you can branch from there.
Uh-huh.
But back in the 70s and 80s, that's why you never saw anybody on anything other than the show that they were on. It's just because the powers that be just would not cast you.
Very interesting.
After that. And they never got, Gilligan's Island's never got, the actors never got residuals for syndication. But I'm sure that people have learned their lesson. It's just like once you hit that 100 episodes, it's like, yeah, we're okay to syndicate now. You better goddamn well pay me if you're going to syndicate this thing.
Yeah. So I imagine Steven Yeun gets some sort of fraction of a cent every time he appears on screen. Maybe more than that. I don't know. Because I mean, this is like his likeness in a current new episode of the show too. I don't know if that makes a difference, but, you would think.
I don't know either.
You would think. So anyways, we're at the tail end of the Founders Day riot here, which of course started at the end of the last episode. We have Eugene and Max, they're running away through the crowd, but they get separated and Daryl appears to pull Eugene into a building because Eugene is in danger, since he's the one who incited the riot, essentially, by playing the tape.
Yeah, take your head off, dude. I mean, if you're going to try and blend into a crowd, change your clothes. Like, take your vest off, take your hat off, put on a different shirt. You know, make it hard for people to find.
I mean, I don't know if he had time to, like, fully change, but you're right. It could be easy to take a hat off or a jacket or something like that. But he's in danger, and Daryl pulls him into a house to try to help him out. And we go to the opening credits. So pretty short. Cold open on this one.
It was pretty short.
When we return from the credits, we have dead Sebastian. He's strapped to a table. Mercer and Pamela are there. She's looking over his body. And she says out loud that she kind of knew he was sort of bad, but she was trying to help because he's family. And then Pamela mentions to Mercer that Max has been loyal for more than 10 years working for her, and she must have just lost her way. So with that in mind, she asks Mercer to make an example of Eugene by arresting him, and in turn, she will help Max kind of go scot-free for her involvement in this debacle.
Right, because, you know, you make deals with the top to political deals.
You make deals. I mean, last week's episode was called A New Deal. Everyone's making deals here, and that's what she is proposing to Mercer anyways. So we see the foam suits, as I'm calling them now, which was coined by a listener last week.
Yeah, perfect. No, it's done.
Yeah.
That's it.
Foam suits are rounding up all associates of Eugene. We see them grabbing Rosita, Princess, and Ezekiel. This was a clip, at least the Rosita one was a clip from the trailer, so now we have context for this. And they're bringing them in for questioning. So we go over to the gang on the road on their way to Oceanside. And if you recall, this is Aaron and Jerry, Lydia and Elijah. Lydia and Elijah, they're kind of flirting. We know they have a thing going on. It's nice. They see a bunch of zombies down the road. And Jerry suggests that they make camp because it's late in the day and they wait it out, just wait for them to pass. But Aaron wants to find a way around and keep moving. He says they don't have time to spare. So they take the wagon and kind of go off-road into the forest, which I got to say does sound like a terrible idea when you have a nice road there that you can follow. You just are going to be delayed a little bit by a few zombies passing by.
And going off-road with a wagon, I mean, with a horse maybe, but with a wagon, not so much.
not such a great idea. No, horse can handle it, but we have a whole wagon full of stuff to pull.
Yeah, we did that one time. Me and a couple of friends in high school, we had a car and somebody's mom's car, my friend's mom's car. And we drove that car. We took it down an old dirt road, and then we decided to take it along a walking path that we had found, and it turned out to be like a biking path.
Yeah.
And we got the car stuck. Like, we went through a creek kind of thing, and then we got the car stuck, and it got stuck on a rock, and we had to jack it up to get over and then push it so it would get over the rock. And then we eventually got that thing out, and it took us hours and hours and hours, and we didn't know if we were going to get that car out at all, but we eventually did. So I learned my lesson. You don't take things that are not supposed to be off-road, off-road.
No, and amazingly, all those zombies around didn't get you while you were doing it.
Yeah, once that car went away, then his mom bought a Jeep. Oh, and then we had some good times with that Jeep. We drove that Jeep off a cliff. Like, we were finding off-roads, and we ended up driving it off this sand cliff, and we were so worried about the thing flipping over, and it didn't flip over. So what did we do? We went to a party that night. We grabbed the two women that we were kind of crushing on at the time, and we went back, and we did that again. They hated it.
I don't blame
them. Didn't work at all.
If they never dated you again after that, I would be like, right decision, ladies.
Well, they did, but that particular instance, they really didn't appreciate being driven off a cliff without any warning.
Yeah.
Anyway, taking things off road, results may vary.
Results may vary. Well, that's what they're doing, and then the camera moves into the zombie herd that I guess was passing by. And we're kind of following behind the zombies a little bit amongst the herd. And one of them stops and turns his head and appears to look at something or be aware of something even. It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
Something going on with that particular zombie. Or possibly Whisperer. As we know, Whisperers walk amongst zombie herds and don't always behave like zombies.
They don't always.
No.
They try to, but they don't.
Don't always. That's right. So we cut back into the Commonwealth, and Rosita is there being interrogated by Mercer. He's trying to go like straight by the book, asking her questions as if they don't know each other. And she's like, are we seriously doing this? You know, do we have to play parts in this conversation and pretend we don't know what's going on here? And, you know, after he's kind of says, yes, that's exactly what we have to do, he starts asking some questions and she answers him. Things like, where were you? What were you doing? Have you seen Eugene? Things like that during the riot.
You see, I think he's trying to help her. And I'll tell you why.
Please do.
I've watched a lot of true crime YouTube crap in the last 9 to 10 months. Like, a lot. And a lot of that has been, almost complete footage of interrogations that have happened between police and ultimately guilty suspects and a few innocent ones, but mostly guilty suspects. The police, when they get into that kind of situation where they have to, when they're questioning someone, they spend a lot of time trying to build rapport, trying to make them seem friendly and to get on common ground. And even if it's a good cop, bad cop situation, or whether it's just, you know, good cop, be friendly kind of thing. So they spend a lot of time being friendly and getting that rapport built so that you can have a conversation. And people, if they don't talk, they don't mess up and say things they don't mean to say.
Right.
So you get them talking. And the best way to do that is to build rapport, to be friendly, and to just start off simple conversations, even answers you already know, just start the conversation going. So Mercer comes in. There is instant rapport between these two. They are friends, for lack of a better word. They are colleagues. They're familiar with each other. That rapport exists. He doesn't use it. He is immediately putting up a barrier between him and her. I think that is a subtle technique in order to get her to just say what he needs to hear to let her go.
Okay, so I understand. You're saying that if there was like a friendly rapport between them, she might reveal too much, or she might say something that incriminates herself because she feels more comfortable. But if they don't have that because he is going by the book and he pisses her off because of it, then she'll be more standoffish and she'll be less inclined to like give up information, which is actually good for her.
Yes, he's trying to get her to not be comfortable, to shut up and to think about what she's going to say and just answer the questions he asks. Don't say anything other than the answers to the questions I'm about to ask you.
That's fantastic. That's a really, really interesting reading of the scene, and not one I would have come to in a million years, I don't think. So, you know, if that's what they were going for, that's great. I think that's
I don't know if it's what they were going for, but that's how I read it based on the, 50, 60 hours of interrogations. There's some good stuff out there. There's some really good stuff out there.
I'm sure.
So seek it out. Watch some interrogations. People are idiots.
It sounds like it'll expand your mind a little bit if you do watch these interrogations.
Every single narrator or commenter that have presented interrogations of people that have confessed to the crimes that they did commit, mm-hmm. all of them invariably say, shut the fuck up, ask for a lawyer. What the hell's the matter with you?
Right.
Stop talking. So if you're ever, it doesn't matter if you're innocent or not, getting a lawyer does not mean you're guilty. Just get a lawyer.
Yeah.
They're going to fuck with your mind. Get a lawyer. Anyway, she doesn't have the right to a lawyer in this particular interrogation, so I think Mercer's trying to help her out.
Interesting. Amazing. Well, ultimately, he asks her to tell Eugene to turn himself in, and if he does, he can help them, but if not, things will be much worse for all of them. So there you go. We go over to Daryl. He's in the church sharpening his big knife, and Rosita arrives and identifies herself at the door so he doesn't stab her on the way in.
Clever.
Yeah. They talk about a plan to sneak everybody out at dawn, but Eugene is there hiding out as well, and he wants to know about Max. So he apologizes for putting them all in this situation, of course, which is not great for anybody. And
he took his hat off. Finally.
Oh, good.
Well, he's in church. I mean, you take your hat off in church. This is, it's what you do.
Yeah. Now he takes his hat off. There you go.
Synagogue. That's another thing. You put the yarmulke on.
That's right. That's right. The one time I've been in a synagogue for somebody's bat mitzvah, I had to put one of those on.
Oh, I was at a wedding in a synagogue. I had to put one on. It was great. It was a fucking great wedding. The groom was a semi-professional ballroom dancer, and his wife was his practice person. So they did this whole thing, and it just blew me away.
I'm sure it did.
I felt very small, inadequate. I'm like, this guy obviously knows what he's doing. At my wedding, I just had a stupid little dance, which I enjoyed with my new wife. That was good and everything. Don't get me wrong. When I call it a stupid little dance, I mean, it was a fantastic, wonderful, romantic moment.
Sure.
Is what I mean by that. But, in this one moment where I saw this guy dancing at this wedding, I felt very inadequate.
Well, you just look at that guy and go, man, he can really dance. I bet he cooks really well, probably great in bed. Like, that guy's just got so much more than I do.
Yeah, absolutely. He was just a hands down, flat out better person than I was and than I will ever be.
Fair enough. All right. Well, how are your ballroom dancing lessons going now?
That does not happen.
All right. Well, that's too bad for you, but I think you've made the best of it. Where are we here? So Eugene apologizes for putting them all in this situation. He says he cannot live without Max. Daryl and Rosita try very hard to convince him to leave, to run away. But ultimately, Rosita agrees to go to look for her and try to, find her and help get her out as well. As she's leaving, Pamela starts making an announcement over the PA about a generous reward for anybody with information about the whereabouts of the fugitives.
Yeah.
So they are looking for them. Now, after a commercial break, we are back with the crew on the road. They have the wagon, or on the off-road, I guess. They have the wagon stuck in a hole now. They're trying to get it out. As they pull, Jerry injures his knee and is bleeding. And wondering what to do, Aaron notices some buildings across a river that they can hide out in.
So if your car gets stuck in a hole, don't try and pull it out.
You need a winch and a pulley and all that and get it out of there.
What I mean is, when all else fails, push, don't pull.
Oh, right.
If you pull, what happens when the car gets unstuck?
Yeah, you fall down, it runs over you.
Yeah, you're in front of that thing, right?
Right.
So this thing is being pulled by a horse.
Yeah.
Right. So it's going to have more horsepower, for lack of a better word, than you. Don't pull. So Jerry was an idiot. I mean, I like Jerry and everything, but he was an idiot in this situation.
I mean, they had to try to get it out somehow. And maybe he was just positioned poorly, right? He should have been pushing it rather than... I think he was trying to lift that wheel out of the hole, too. You know, you needed someone doing that, but either way.
There are no doctors. There are no surgeons. Well, there's very few doctors and surgeons. Commonwealth has both. But generally speaking, this is a zombie apocalypse. There's no trauma centers. There's no ambulance. There's no air ambulance. You're not being airlifted to a trauma center when your leg gets crushed underneath the wheel being pulled by a horse. Fucking take care of yourself.
Just be careful. Yeah, be careful.
Be mindful of what you're doing. Be aware that things move forward when you're trying to get them to move forward. And if you're in the way of that thing moving forward, when it suddenly moves forward, you're going to be in the way.
That's true. So Aaron notices these buildings and we get this great camera shot of it like flying through a hole in the fence into this collection of buildings that are a Renaissance fair. Again, something we saw in the trailer and is now explained. Lydia helps.
Drones are awesome.
Drones are cool.
It was a CG fence.
Yeah.
But it was a drone shot, right?
Yes.
So, yeah. Or at least maybe two drone shots. But, you know, drones are getting really good at moving cameras around. So there's lots of good footage out there nowadays.
It was cool. I thought it was really nicely done.
And it's the kind of thing you can't do with film, right? They started this show. We were talking about this last week. They started this show, filming it on film rather than like digital video. But now we switched to digital video. You can't get a drone to take a film camera and do things with it, right?
I don't think so. They're just too big. Yeah.
They're too big. The focus is too hard. Like you have to pull focus, manual focus, or even autofocus is a little bit wonky. But once you get into the digital realm, you can get some really interesting shots.
Yeah, I think this was one of them. It was a good transition from, you know, they're in the forest to now they're into the Renaissance Fair. You know, they just flew right in there. We didn't need to see them getting there. We just know they did. So they're around. They're there. Lydia helps Elijah start a fire, and they almost kiss, but Lydia backs away. Jerry's really excited about the place. He says it could be Kingdom 2.0. But Aaron isn't really listening and he's frustrated with whatever he's doing. So he and Lydia decide to take the first watch together while the other two get some rest.
Nice.
So over to Pamela again. She's still tending to Sebastian's body. She's wiping blood off his face. She talks to him about their strained relationship and she seems genuinely sad that he's dead. I thought, after all this kind of asking, you know, what are we left with, sort of, you know?
It's her son. What do you expect?
Well, I guess so, yeah. She should be genuinely kind of sad that he's dead. But in the scene before, she admits, you know, I know he was kind of a dick, but...
Yeah, but all debts are paid once you're dead.
Right? I guess so. That's true, yeah. She does say, though, we don't have to disappoint each other anymore. That's kind of what you're saying, in a way. All debts are paid, yeah. So he starts to wake up as a zombie... And she leaves and tells the foam suit outside the door to take care of that. And that's it.
Right. Sure.
I mean, I guess he knew what she meant because, you know, we'll talk about it in a minute, but he didn't really take care of it.
Well, he kind of did. We don't know what orders she had given previously. Like it all works out in the wash, right?
Yeah.
We assume one thing, but it's totally something else.
It's totally something else, yeah. For now, we go back over to police HQ. Princess is waiting for Mercer. He comes in and they talk about what's going on. She's pissed, of course, that Mercer is going along with Pamela's plan to find Eugene. And she talks about Eugene saving her and being a good person. And, you know, good people don't do what he did. But Mercer says he's looking out for his family, meaning Max, and Princess questions, what's the point of this whole place if a good man is put to death? Talking about Eugene. Because they all figure he's going to be executed for what he did. Back with Aaron and Lydia on their watch. They're kind of up on this walkway between two of the Renaissance Fair buildings. And she he asks if everything is good with her and Elijah. And she said she had some thoughts of Henry, and she's afraid to get too close to him for fear of losing him. And then Aaron tells her a story about his former partner, Eric. Everyone remembers Eric, of course. He says that Eric was asking him out for 6 months, and he kept saying no. And eventually he said yes, and their time together turned out to be the happiest moments of his life. And Aaron says he would take back all those no's so he could just have one more day together with Eric. And he says, loss is going to happen, but the only thing we can control is when we say yes.
There you go. That doesn't mean everybody should always say yes.
Well, no, of course not.
Unless you're in a comedy troupe where you yes and?
Yeah, yeah. If you're doing a yes and game, that's different.
What's that called where you?
I think it's called yes and.
No, it's where, you know, comedy people get on stage and they improv. Just kind of improv. That's it.
I see.
Unless you're in some kind of improv group.
Right.
Saying yes and.
Yeah.
Is not always the best thing. Sometimes you have to say no.
Of course. But I think this story was remarkably sweet and really, really just important in the situation. And I think it served its purpose quite well.
He wasn't telling her to always say yes to everybody about everything. What he was saying was say yes to this time.
And sometimes, right? Like, I just think shows do this a lot, right? Where there's a character needs to hear something and another character doesn't just tell them. They conveniently have a story that illustrates the point they want to make in the perfect way, right? TV shows, movies, it happens all the time. It's just a thing that writers do. And sometimes it bugs me because I'm like, the perfect story is just waiting right there all the time at any given moment, you know, to make your point. This one I thought really, really worked so well. And maybe it's because we knew Eric as a character.
Yes. You know? So it's something we knew about.
Yeah.
It wasn't something from before, which that, they just threw at Aaron's backstory. It was something that we were aware of and that, it meant more to us and therefore meant more in the moment. I agree.
Yeah. And I thought it was really, really nice. So control when we say yes. After the scene, though, we get a wide shot of a zombie hand reaching up to the top of the fence. So that fence we flew through a minute ago now has a zombie hand climbing over it.
Oh, man, zombie hands.
Well, man. Max, back in the Commonwealth, Max is hiding in the darkness. She sees Rosita and starts to run out to her, but there are foam suits all around and they apprehend her. So Max does not get away. She gets taken in by the authorities.
Mm-hmm.
Go to a commercial break, and when we return, Max is now in the interrogation room reading a prepared statement, and it's essentially throwing Eugene under the bus and exonerating herself. None of it is true, of course, but Mercer is there and says she has to sign the statement. He's trying to help her get off without punishment, but Max refuses because she says she started this. This place was so rotten, and she reminds him that their father used to say, speak truth, no matter the cost. And she says their father would have liked Eugene, but would have been ashamed of Mercer and refuses to sign. Another great scene, I thought. Like, a little weird that, like, she's in there alone with Mercer and they're related and stuff like that. But who cares? I thought it was such a deep burn for her to say that to her brother. Our father would be ashamed of you for what you're doing.
Well, yeah, that's quite a burn. But I question the speak truth no matter what the cost statement. I mean, that does seem like a nice thing to say and a nice pillar of wisdom to live by, but it absolutely is not true. And I'm sorry to say it, but it's not true. Sometimes you don't have to be brutally honest in all situations. You can not say something. If the only reason you're telling somebody the truth is so that you feel better and it won't do any good, I question whether or not you should do it.
Well, I understand that. And it's what you're talking about is the whole idea of, sometimes it's better to say nothing at all, right? If you're going to hurt somebody's feelings or whatever, sometimes it's better to just say nothing. I get that. But when you're talking about big truths, I think most of the time
Transparency is nice.
Yeah.
Transparency is a good goal to live by. Yeah. I would say that, you know, but speak truth. I don't know. Transparency, you know, telling, you know, for organizations and for processes and, you know, things that you do. I generally agree with that. But I, you know, from a, on a personal level, you don't always have to be, you know, honest in all situations.
Well, fine.
It's not absolutely necessary.
But in this situation, we are talking about an institutional systemic level of things, right? And if things are rotten, I think that's the kind of thing you want to speak out about.
Yeah. I'm having a hard time with advice given in this episode that is given in a way that is meant to be taken universally, but should be taken in these specific circumstances.
Well, okay, fine.
Speak. Don't speak truth all the time. Just speak truth in this situation. You know, don't say yes all the time, but just say yes in this situation.
Well, again, this isn't as much of a story that fits the narrative perfectly situation like the last one was. But because, again, these two characters are related and we don't know anything about their father, but you can feel that obviously they both knew their father, and she uses his sort of goodness against her brother here, who's not acting the way she thinks he should be. And again, I think it worked really well. You know, take out the sort of universality of what she's saying, but within this situation, I thought it worked really well. Another really great interaction between two characters.
Yeah, we did get some good backstory. I'll agree with that.
Yeah, a little bit. All right, so we go back over to Eugene. He's looking out a window at the church. Daryl comes in, questions what he's doing, and then Eugene tries to leave the room, but Daryl just sort of stands there blocking his way. So Eugene rolls up his sleeves, puts his fists up as if to fight Daryl, and instead Daryl just stands there looking at him and then tells him to go ahead. And Eugene starts to walk and he says, "You're not trying to stop me." Daryl says, "No, because you ain't going."
Yeah.
Not because Eugene is a coward, but because he's smart. And he says that the only reason he survived is because he's lied to everybody all the time. And he's sort of upset about that. And he asks Daryl if people are born brave or if they become brave. And Daryl says both.
Yep.
Here's a funny sort of scene, I thought. Like, I think what the show was going for is Eugene's looking out the window and thinking about actually going outside to look for Max. But then he's sort of in an inner room of the church. So he has to first leave that room, and Daryl's blocking that door. So it seemed like Daryl was just blocking his way from like one room to the next room, and Eugene goes to fight him, which I thought was really, really funny. So this one didn't work as well for me for that reason, because it didn't feel like Eugene was like trying to get out of the church. He was just trying to like go to the bathroom or something, you know?
I don't know if he really wanted to leave. He knows that Daryl knows him, right? So he knows that he shouldn't leave.
Yeah.
I think he's just trying to, he's posturing, I think. I think he's just trying to, he's trying to get across that he can't live without Max. He needs to, he needs to go and, have her saved, but he doesn't want to do it by himself. So he is posturing. He's trying to relay how important this is to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm not entirely convinced that he wanted to leave, because I don't think he opened the window until he knew that Daryl was there.
Well, I'm not sure. I thought he closed the window as Daryl came in, but all I'm trying to say is I never had the feeling, like, I didn't quite understand why Eugene was immediately like, "I want to fight you because you're in my way," because I never had the feeling that Eugene was trying to like leave the church. I thought he was just looking out the window and then was trying to leave the room. And I'm like, why is he trying to fight him from preventing him to go from one room to the other? I didn't really get that. But I think it was because we're supposed to believe that Eugene wanted to like go out on his own, or at least, like you said, make it seem like he did.
Yeah.
So I thought this was a little confusing.
It was a bit weird. It was a bit muddied.
Yeah, exactly. I think so. But I also started thinking how Daryl and Eugene, I mean, have they really interacted much over all these years, those two characters? I can't think of too many scenes where those two characters really had important direct interactions on the show. This is one of the few.
It is. I don't rewatch episodes, so I don't know, but
yeah,
it does seem like a new situation.
I'm sure they've spoken. I'm sure they've had words at times in an episode, but I can't think of too many examples. I'm sure people are going to write in and be like, what about this and this and this and this and all these important things. But, you know, in the moment, I was like, huh, these two guys haven't interacted that much. And here they are, and it's kind of weird. Maybe that's why.
You think Eugene's going to Paris? I think everybody's going to Paris with Daryl. I think the whole show is going to go to Paris with Daryl. It's going to be the Walking Dead, the Dixon monologue. What's it called?
The Dixon contingency in Paris.
Sorry, I'm thinking of the vagina monologues.
Totally different.
Yeah, very, very different. Puppetry of the penis, that was the other thing. Man, the 90s were weird. That was the 90s, right?
I don't know, yeah, but I've heard of it.
Anyway, if they're setting up a relationship between Daryl and Eugene that wasn't really there before, I question whether or not Eugene's going to Paris.
Maybe that's just what Jason calls every time he takes a shower.
I'm going to Paris.
That's not what I meant. Anyways, commercial break.
Or were you talking about puppetry of the penis?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's not what I call it.
Okay. I don't want to know. After a commercial break, we are with Princess, and she's chatting with Ezekiel, and she talks about the rest of them meeting up with everybody else there, and they're going to sneak out. But Ezekiel says, of course, he's not leaving. He says, there's no better time to fight for change while the powers that be are frightened of it. So he wants to stay in the Commonwealth and sort of keep the fight going. She now makes a compelling point to him, I thought, that this place isn't worth it. They both talk about Mercer and what he's doing, and Ezekiel even says maybe he's just trying to make the best of a bad situation. And they agree that Princess deserves more than just the best of a bad situation. So, you know, he respects whatever decision she's going to make, whether it's stay or go or anything like that. We cut over to Lance, who is in a large cell, just on his knees. That's it. And Pamela comes in. And I'd just like to point out here, Jason, that there is some inspired wardrobe selection for Pamela Milton in this episode, because look at that red sort of jacket she's wearing. It's got these red beaded flowers on it. And what do they look like?
Blood splatter.
They look like blood splatter, blood stains. I thought it was so well done. And
blood spatter. Man, blood splatter.
One or the other. I think both words work. But I couldn't help but notice it. I'm like, this is so great. It just looks like she has blood all over her, but she doesn't. It's just the jacket she's wearing. So good on the wardrobe selection here, I would say.
Let's talk about the room for a second. So the room is very, I want to say perfectly dirty. Like, it's perfect. It's the amount of dirt and grime in this room is exquisite.
Yeah.
It's very, it seems a little too dirty tidy. Like, it's, you know, there's two different scales for, you know, cleanliness. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, is it dirty or clean versus is it tidy or messy, right? You can have dirty tidy, but you can also have dirty messy, right?
Yeah.
This is perfectly dirty and perfectly tidy.
Because there's nothing in it.
There's nothing in it. It seems like if this room was so tidy, would it really be this dirty?
Good question. I don't know.
So I'm wondering about this room.
Okay.
It's a little too perfect.
It's a little too perfect. All right. Well, I just looked at it and was like, it's big for one guy. And why is he on his knees? Like, nobody's there. Why not just stand or sit on your butt? You know, I don't understand. But he was on his knees.
Yeah, I got bad knees. There's no way I'd be on my knees.
Well, that's what I mean, yeah. So anyways, Pam comes in. Lance initially thinks she's there to release him, and he starts to talk about a way forward. But he realizes that's not really the case, and he starts to say he needed to get her attention, but he never intended for Sebastian to get killed. He tries to convince her that he's always been there for her and her family, and he sort of goes on to try to blame the people from Hilltop and Alexandria for everything that happened instead of himself. She reaches into his pocket and takes out his lucky coin that we've seen before, and then she uses his own thing against him by making him choose a hand, which one she's holding the coin in, and she says, if, you know, if you win, you live. If you lose, something else happens.
Right. This is after she gives him the Vulcan neck pinch. Like, she just pinches his neck right at the base of his neck.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, I mean, you kind of look like a Vulcan and everything, but I don't think that's going to work in this situation.
No. Is this where, too, she kind of, like, rubs her hands in his mouth almost a little bit? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's odd.
It's odd. It's
creepy. Were they lovers?
I don't know. It's creepy, though.
I don't know. It seems like a very angry, intimate moment.
It does.
And it's confusing.
Yeah, it is confusing. But like, you could, I think, interpret it as her sort of having power over him. You know, he's on his knees, bound. She can do whatever she wants to him. But it's creepy, creepily intimate. You're right.
It oddly enough, it made me feel like every time, it's been a long time since I've been to a strip club, but it reminded me of how I feel going to a strip club. When I've been dragged to strip clubs and gone to strip clubs because of bachelor parties or whatever.
Completely against your will.
Well, totally against, well, not always, but generally speaking, I've been dragged to places. I don't feel comfortable in them. I've been kicked out of a strip club because I was reading.
Yeah,
I wanted some place to get a cold beer and to cool off. It was the middle of the summer. It was hot. I wanted to just cool off. So I went in and I started reading, and the bouncer asked me to leave. It's like, I just want to read a book and drink a beer. I mean, it just happened. Anyway, when I go to strip clubs, the juxtaposition of nudity without intimacy is confusing to me. It doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel emotionally connected to a person that is nude in front of me. It makes me feel weird.
Sure.
I don't like it. So this is sort of like that, in that there, it seems like a very intimate moment, but there's a lot of anger, right?
Yeah.
And it feels very awkward, very juxtaposition of two different things that shouldn't be in the same moment. And it's very odd.
I think that's what they were going for, though, right? If you felt awkward and sort of not upset is the right word, but
awkward is pretty
uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable,
right?
Yeah.
I think that's what they wanted you to feel, and it worked.
Well, yeah. Okay. Well, it worked.
Well, he has to choose a hand. He chooses the hand with the coin and seems very relieved, and then thanks her. And he promises he's 100% at the Milton family's disposal and will do better. So then she opens the cell door, and a couple of foam suit soldiers bring in zombie Sebastian on one of those, like, dog control neck things, you know, sticks. And then they bring in Calhoun, who's been shot dead in the head.
Oh.
Yeah. They untie Lance and leave a machete on the floor. Pamela says, "The body's still warm. Feed my son, Lance." So what exactly is going on here, Jason? I think Pam wants Lance to A, protect himself from zombie Sebastian, B, chop up Calhoun and feed him to Sebastian. You know, maybe Lance gets killed too, maybe not. I think she's just like, see what you do in this situation. But what's the point of it all?
This is a test. This is the same thing as when the Joker in A Dark Knight went into their room and said, you know, we're having tryouts.
Right.
Right. And he breaks the pool cue in half, and there's three people and he only has room for two more henchmen, kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Or one more henchman. This is a test. It is, if you are at the Milton family's disposal, here I have your dead dude. I have my undead son. Feed my son means don't kill him. If you want to make your way back into my good graces, mm-hmm. you now have to survive in this room without killing my zombie son. But luckily, I've given you some food to give to him, but the food is made up of someone, your henchman,
uh-huh.
kind of thing. So let's see how long you can last in this room without being killed or killing my undead son with this dead food here.
And eventually she'll come back and he will either have succeeded or will be dead.
Or will have killed her son.
Or will have killed Sebastian, right. Okay.
Which means that he will be dead.
Got it. That is a hell of a test. And yeah. I love it.
Yeah. That's the only thing I can think of because it doesn't make any sense.
Well, it totally makes sense when you frame it like that. It is a test. And I just wasn't sure. I kind of knew that, but I wasn't sure sort of what she was getting at, what the test was. But you're right. It's keep Sebastian, you know, quote unquote, alive for as long as you can until I get back. And, you know, you have some food to feed him. And once that's all gone, you better not run out of energy because you're going to have to run around this room and not let him get you.
Yeah.
So very, very cool. Now that you've explained it, I think it's a great scene.
Well, it's one of the tenets of surviving the zombie apocalypse, right? Cardio. Mm-hmm. You know, just run around in circles until I get back, I guess.
Cardio.
Zombies don't get tired.
They do not. They do not. Anyways, we cut over to Princess, who's at her apartment packing up to leave. Mercer arrives and wants to talk. He, of course, doesn't want her to leave because, don't forget, they have a relationship, an intimate one. He says that he is doing everything in his power to make sure Eugene doesn't die, and he tries to tell her that the Commonwealth may not be perfect, but it's worse outside. You know, things might not be great in here, but there's nothing out there for you.
The grass is always browner.
That's right. Now, for the third time this episode, she tells him a life story about something that is relevant and, you know, poignant in the moment. And it's about her father leaving and how her stepdad and then stepbrother came into the scene, physically abused her. Her mother let it happen. And they'd say things like, you have a roof over your head and the bills are paid. It could be a lot worse out there. You don't know how good you have it. And with another F-bomb drop in this final block of episodes, she says, fuck that thinking. It may be bad, but it could also be a lot better. And this is why she has to go. Even though the Commonwealth could be a lot worse, things can be better. And you have to look at it that way. And then before she leaves, she says to Mercer that all throughout her life, when she sees a man, she sees a monster. For as long as time, she's felt that way. But she tells him that he's not a monster. I'm telling you, dude, I think this works so well, too. And I don't even know why, because I feel less of a connection to these characters. I feel more of a connection to Princess than I do to Mercer. But I loved it. I thought it was so well done. I thought Princess was amazing in this scene, the way she sat there and told this story. And you could feel that she meant it, like she actually experienced all this. And it was amazing. I just thought it was one of the most convincing scenes I've seen between anybody, and these two especially. It was really, really good.
I don't want to belittle what you just said, because I actually agree with you. But how can you see somebody as a monster when they're dressed up like a pumpkin?
I mean, jack-o'-lantern, they're kind of monsterish.
But really? Anyway, I don't mean to belittle what you said by making a joke, but I agree that, you know, we've gotten a little more visibility into Princess's character and backstory, which is nice. Mercer, he still seems kind of stoic.
Yeah.
I think we need to see him without his costume on.
And we have briefly, but only like when they're in bed, I think, maybe.
Yeah. I think we need more time without his pumpkin outfit on.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with Mercer if the Commonwealth falls and he, you know, flees or joins our group or whatever. I have no idea what's going to happen, but I think you might be right. Like, this wasn't a good scene because of him. It was a good scene because of Princess.
Yeah.
And you're right. Mercer is very stoic. He doesn't give us a lot of emotion. And I guess that kind of works for that character, but I would like to see a little bit more from him at some point, if there's time, which there probably isn't.
Probably not.
Probably not.
And what's with all the rugs rolled up under her the bench at the end of her bed, though?
I don't know. I mean, maybe she only has so much floor space and she rotates the rugs in and out from storage.
I don't know. It's a little bit odd. Okay. It's just all these rugs are they're not even, they sort of could have been, I thought they were towels at first, but they're kind of rag rugs, you know, rag rugs.
Yeah.
Or knotted up rags. They look like a bunch of rugs all rolled up in tubes and placed underneath this bench at the foot of her bed. And it didn't make any sense.
Well, maybe she's a collector of rugs and she needs somewhere to store her collection.
Yeah. Okay. It was weird.
Why not? Anyways, we can figure the rugs out later. If anyone has any theories, let us know. For now, we go back to the Renaissance Fair, and Lydia and Aaron are sitting around a fire at night. They hear some noises, and it turns out to be a bunch of zombies inside the walls. Where the hell did they come from?
Oh, geez.
Yeah, so they start fighting them. One of the zombies grabs Lydia's staff weapon that she's using and sort of yanks on it, and then she stabs the zombie in the shoulder with a knife and leaves the knife in him. So her and Aaron yell to wake up the other two. They run out to help. And, you know, Jerry's knee must be feeling pretty good because we get one of the most epic single shot multi-zombie kill scenes the show has ever done.
Yeah.
In my opinion, he stands there in sort of semi-slow motion, swinging around, is it a machete or some kind of sharp blade? And he takes out four zombies with just fluid slicing motions as the camera spins around him. It was so great, I thought.
Nice. Well, I think Jerry, I like Jerry. I think he's great.
Yes.
And they're giving him a very big hero moment here. Which makes me feel good about Jerry and worry about him all at the same time.
Yeah, I guess so. But I thought it was a really cool scene. Whatever it went into making that happen, totally worth it.
Yeah.
So the gang takes cover inside of one of the buildings because there's zombies all over the place. And they notice the doorknob turning from the outside. And Jerry questions, when the hell did the dead start using doorknobs?
And since the first day of zombies. The first time we saw a zombie do anything, it was turning a fucking doorknob.
Yeah, but that was, well, before Jerry was around. And they kind of wrote that out of the show until now, right?
They sure did.
Yeah. Well, Aaron assumes that there are whisperers in the crowd because this is the kind of thing that whisperers do. And we saw that zombie earlier on turn and look at something in the same way a whisperer would. And of course, the hand coming over the fence. Well, a whisperer could climb a fence. It must be a whisperer, right?
Yeah, I would assume so.
It must be. Anyways, Aaron tells Eli, he called him Eli in this episode instead of Elijah. And I like it. It's rolls off the tongue better.
Yeah, there you go.
So he tells Eli and Lydia to climb up to the roof. They get up there. They see a lot of zombies crowding down around the building. They get Jerry up there while Aaron holds the door. And Jerry ends up sitting on the roof with his injured knee. It seems to be bothering him now all of a sudden. Maybe he re-injured it in the big multi-zombie slow motion scene.
Well, adrenaline can do a lot for you. It can make you forget about things that hurt quite a bit.
That's very,
very true.
For a
little while.
Yeah.
But then it comes back and goes, hey, your buddy goes, hey, remember? Your knee fucking hurts, dude. Yeah. You better sit down.
Yeah. Still got a problem here. So they're on the roof. They formulate this plan for Lydia and Eli to jump down and flank around the building. Aaron says he'll go back down and go the other way, and they'll separate the whisperers from the group and take them out. But meanwhile, a zombie has climbed up a ladder or something onto the roof and picks up a rock. So,
cool.
Again, must be a whisperer. Just in time, though, he's coming at Jerry. Just in time, Aaron comes to fight it off. And at this moment, he still thinks it's a whisperer. So he gets it down on the ground. He's punching it in the face. He goes to tear its mask off, but he just gets face. And turns out it's an actual zombie. So he stabs it in the head, and him and Jerry wonder what the hell is going on.
What the fuck?
So variant. So we've got a zombie that looks around, hears things, climbs fences, turns doorknobs, climbs a ladder, picks up a rock, and then is finally killed. Luckily, he had that knife still stuck in his chest that Lydia left there. So he can do all these things, but not pull a knife out of his chest.
Yeah. We have to establish that this is the same zombie, right? It's the same zombie that turned to look. It's the same zombie that grabbed Lydia's staff yep. that she stabbed him with. It's the That's same right. zombie that climbed the thing, grabbed the rock, fought the thing, and had its face so loose that it just kind of was able to be ripped off.
Yeah.
So I think it's a very good way of uniquely identifying this particular zombie. There's no question that this is the same zombie.
No question.
He didn't grab the knife, which I thought was a little bit odd. He uses a rock rather than a knife. Mm-hmm. He's not a very smart dead person.
No, I guess not. But, I mean, he does a lot of things different than the rest of them. So I guess he just doesn't know. He doesn't know that, you know, I got this weapon stuck in me that would be really good right now. You know, but he does do a lot of things different.
Yep.
So there you go. Anyways, the next morning, they've killed all the walkers, and Aaron mentions that there have been roamers and lurkers, but there's ones that have seemed to go back to places they remember, which of course we've seen. And he says he's heard stories of walkers that can climb walls and open doors. And then it makes him wonder what other kinds there are out there as well.
Yeah.
So after all the great interpersonal dialogue scenes and things like that between other characters, this one, it bothered me in the trailer and it bothered me now too. And I think the reason is the same. It's because even though if we go back to season one in the Frank Darabont era, and this kind of thing was kind of seeded into the show originally, it has been gone since then. It was very specifically removed from the show until now. And the way Aaron says, I've heard stories of walkers that can climb walls and open doors, I want to have heard those stories. That's what would have brought it together for me. Yeah. The fact that no one has ever brought this up on the show before now, yet apparently it's a thing, I think is a clumsy way to introduce it. I'm not upset that they are introducing it. I don't mind if they're making walkers do new things, or now this is going to be a thing. You know, we know there's fast and strong walkers in France, and if walkers here in America can do new things, that's okay. But they're kind of springing it on us in a way, and I think they could have seeded it into the show better, but they would have had to plan way ahead for that, and I guess they didn't.
Well, the other way you could have done it is have everybody discover this thing at the same time as the audience, instead of Aaron having heard of stories. Like, why bring that up? Just say, oh, this is new. I didn't know zombies could do this. Let's try and figure out what the fuck.
That's a really good point.
You know, why put that in there? You know, why write it into a backstory, which just, it's, you know, it's dissident.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, it doesn't ring true. It kind of sounds like a sour note.
Yeah. Even though, like, I think what they're trying to do is tie it back to that original first season, right? But it's just too long ago, in my opinion, in real world time and in show time. And I think you're right. Maybe if they just make the audience find out about this at the same time as the characters, it would have worked a little better. Like, have Aaron be more shocked and surprised or confused about what's happening, you know? Don't give him the ability to explain it away with, I've heard stories, but never thought it was true. Dun, 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 you know?
Yeah.
Doesn't work as well.
Stories from who?
Yeah.
You know, cite your sources there, dude. What the fuck?
From who? From where? You know, whatever. So.
I want two independently corroborated sources for this information that you have.
Yes. We're not going to get it.
No, we're not going to get it.
No, we are not.
We're just going to get police say.
Yeah, that's right. So we now have Lydia and Eli. They're loading up the cart. As they do this, she stops and kisses him for real this time. She took Aaron's advice to heart.
Mm-hmm, for real kisses.
For real, that's right. And they looked very happy, which made me happy.
Well, kissing is very pleasing.
Yes, exactly. I'm glad they're getting it together, those two. The four of them ride the cart out of the place, and Aaron reminds Jerry about it being maybe Kingdom 2.0. And Aaron says that this place seems like King Jerry would be in charge, not King Ezekiel.
Oh.
Nice. Nice little bit there, I thought. Okay, Daryl and Rosita, they come back into the church, and she informs Eugene that the police picked up Max. She wasn't able to get to her in time. So Daryl says they got to leave, and Eugene still says he won't come. Then Rosita tries to convince him, but he questions what kind of man he'd be if he didn't try to be with the love of his life, Max. He explains that she makes him better, and he sees no path forward without her. And he reminds Rosita that she once said that his person is out there, and now he's found her, and he has to do whatever he can to be with her. And Rosita's upset, but she's convinced, and she's crying. And then Eugene takes the thing he wears around his neck off and gives it to Coco. Now, I say the thing he wears around his neck because I think there's probably a name for whatever that thing is, but I don't know what the word is.
Pendant?
Pendant, maybe. It's one of you see cowboys wear them a lot, don't you?
Like a string tie?
Kind of. It's like a, well, it is like a pendant or a medallion type thing with two, each end of the string going through it and hanging down below it, kind of. I don't know if there's a word for it, but.
Cowboy tie.
Sure, a cowboy tie. He takes his cowboy tie off and he says, give this to Coco. One day she'll have the style to pull it off. And they both hug. They're goodbyes.
Yeah, like a Canadian tuxedo.
Right. We all have the style to pull that off.
Yeah.
Being Canadian and all. So next scene is Eugene walking into police HQ, where, of course, they arrest him. They get him down on his knees. He says he's here to confess to the recording and unintentional death of Sebastian. He tells Mercer that he acted alone. Max had nothing to do with any of it, and they take him away.
Yeah. So how'd he get here? Everybody's looking for him. How did he get to police headquarters without being seen?
Maybe it's right next door.
Right to the church.
To the church, yeah.
Yeah, what do you call those doors between hotel rooms?
Conjoining doors?
Conjoining doors, yeah. There's some kind of conjoined entranceway into the police station.
Obviously, because he just walked right in and said, here I am, everybody.
Still without a hat. Like, he must have come right from the church without stopping, without passing go. He did not collect $200.
No.
He left his hat at the church.
He must have. Yeah, he must have. That's why they couldn't find him, because they were looking for a guy in a hat.
Yeah. So I guess that worked. I mean, my original idea was solid.
It really was. Take off your hat and you'll be like, you're invisible.
Yeah, it's like Clark Kent in his glasses. Put Absolutely. On the glasses. Nobody can see you. I don't know who you are.
No.
Or Batman with his cowl.
Well, it's a little better, I think.
Well, you know, he can't turn his neck, but whatever.
Yeah, whatever. So we get a quick shot of Max in the interrogation room still with Mercer looking on. And I guess we just are assuming that he's told her what Eugene did. There's no dialogue. There's nothing. It's a pretty quick shot, but really interesting sort of slanted camera angles, I thought. Maybe just trying to portray the confusion of all this or something like that. But
yeah, she's reeling from the news. She's it's vertigo. It's I feel woozy. I don't know what's going on. Down is not down. Down is kind of sideways. I better sit.
Yeah. Okay. That works for me. And then we end up with Eugene sitting in a cell. The camera just pans across the bars of the cell and then transitions into Rosita packing her stuff up in her apartment, I guess, looking at the cowboy pendant. Is that what we're calling it?
Cowboy tie. So the cell that Eugene is in.
Yeah.
This is the right kind of dirty.
Oh, okay.
So just so you know, because we can see like the dirt and grime from this cell is from water damage. Like there's water leaking in down below. There's mold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not uniform. It looks like there's, you know, old leaks that were not cleaned up.
Sure.
That's fine. This is the right kind of dirty. The other one was just a little too uniformly dirty around. and the different panels.
Got it.
But this is the right kind of dirty.
All right. Well, dirt works like this. It doesn't work like it does in the old place.
I'm an expert in grime distribution.
Yes, you are. So, okay. So the camera pans across these cell bars. We don't really, he's just sitting there. And it transitions into Rosita looking at the cowboy pendant that Eugene left with her. She packs it into a bag. And then here's somebody out in the kitchen. She walks out and is immediately attacked by two men. So she fights back quite capably, I must say, but she is overwhelmed. They put a hood over her head. We go to black. And that's the end of the episode.
Yep.
So, holy crap, Jason. I thought this was a really, really good episode of The Walking Dead. I loved every second of it, even despite the couple of weird little bits that I didn't quite get. But I thought almost everything here was really, really good. The technical stuff, the pacing, the cinematography, the direction, I thought it was all fantastic. So much of it reinforced the connections between these characters for me, and I've talked about that a lot in some of these scenes. The Rosita and Eugene stuff, especially the part at the end where, they're saying goodbye. That thing with Daryl and Eugene, it was kind of funny, but it ended up being an important connection between the two of them, I think. Lydia and Eric, Mercer and Max. I thought it was all so good. I really, yeah. Really like this one.
I really think that, every show, I assume, I don't know how shows work. I don't know how shows are produced or anything like that. But I assume that there is a control room somewhere where the showrunner is in there tweaking things. This is where he, his headquarters for running the show. And it's sort of like the control room of a nuclear power plant or the CIC of a battleship of some kind. So there's a lot going on, right?
Okay.
So it seems, so that's what I assume what happens, that every show has one of these control rooms. It seems that the showrunners or the producers for the last 8 episodes walked up to this very important panel and then just grabbed onto the suck knob and turned it down almost all the way.
Yeah.
Because it seems like for a long time, not particularly this show, but other Walking Dead properties, that they've come into that control room and that suck knob got jiggled, or somebody's elbow, or somebody put coffee on it, or spilled coffee into the control knob. But that suck knob kind of got stuck on 7. Uh-huh. Now it's been for the last thing, they jimmied the knob and they turned the suck knob all the way, or not all the way down, but down quite a bit.
Pretty so close,
they,
yeah.
They got control of that knob finally.
Well, that's wonderful news, because I don't think any of these final block of episodes have been bad, but this is the best of the three so far. So maybe they've been slowly turning that suck knob down. They had it way high when Fear was on and being made, the last season of Fear. The first season of World Beyond, it was a little up there, but it came down a bit for the second season of World Beyond. And, for Tales, it was all over the place on Tales, I would say.
Yeah.
But they've got it dialed in down to the lowest point right now, because this was a good episode.
It was. The Mackie board we were talking about that I have that I use for this podcast.
Yeah.
As it turns out, I have an idiot knob on there, and it was jammed pretty high up there until recently. So I turned the idiot knob down a bit. So, we're tweaking the settings here.
Okay.
Just to try and settle things in a little bit. So sure. I understand, I've got the suck knob turned, set just right. Let's just say it's set perfectly, but the idiot knob was a little bit too high. So I turned that down a bit.
A little bit too high. I'm glad, because you don't want to be an idiot too much.
Yeah. And when you recognize that the idiot knob is turned up too high, the best thing to do is to just turn it down.
Turn it down. Yeah.
Turn it down.
Turn it down.
That's all you got to do.
Bring the idiot level down just enough. Yeah.
Yeah. Just small adjustments.
All right. So you like this one too, though?
I did.
Good. Yeah, I think this was a great episode. I can't wait to hear what everybody, the listeners, thought of it. And we'll get more into that when we do a feedback show later this week.
Surely.
Of course, though, before we wrap up this here podcast, we've got to get into the Patreon Prize-a-Palooza. First off, I just want to welcome and thank one new patron this week. That's Cheryl Q. Thank you, Cheryl, nice. For going to patreon.com/thetalkingdead and signing up to become a patron. So this week's prize is an Alpha Unmasked Funko Pop character.
It's cool.
Pretty cool. And before I tell you what next week's prize is, we have to give this week's away. That's how this works, right?
Surely.
So, Jason, why don't you reveal, if you will, the winner of this week's Patreon prize, a Palooza prize?
Okay, so this week I decided to, well, I actually started this a number of weeks ago, but I decided to do something that would be completely illegal in the United States.
Oh my goodness.
This is completely illegal. You cannot do this in the United States, what I am doing for this particular prize drop.
But legal in Canada?
Legal in Canada, oddly enough.
Interesting.
And I'll tell you why after I reveal what we've been what I've done.
Okay.
As a number of weeks ago, I decided to make pickled eggs. So what I did was, after I was done boiling the eggs and getting them all ready, before I put them into the brine, the perfectly seasoned brine, I decided to take the names of all the patrons and roll them up into little capsules and stuff the capsules inside the eggs, and then put the eggs into the brine. So I'm ready to eat the first pickled egg out of my collection of jars of pickled eggs that I made, hundreds and hundreds of pickled eggs.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm going to eat a pickled egg, and I'm going to pull the name out of this capsule.
That's amazing.
Do you know why this is illegal in the United States?
No, but I would imagine something to do with food safety or something, but then I can't imagine it's illegal to pickle things generally in the States yourself.
No, pickling, no. But Kinder eggs, for example, are illegal in the United States, but
right. They're
perfectly legal in Canada. The idea is that you cannot put objects inside food and for a safety reason.
Oh, I
and
see.
But Kinder eggs, you know, really, everybody knows there's something in there, and it's not like you're going to eat a whole Kinder egg and accidentally swallow food. But the idea is that you don't have quarters in cakes, right? And you serve a piece of cake with a bunch of quarters in it. Oh, you found the quarters. Like, no, kids choke on that shit.
But that was a thing that we did at birthday parties. I was at birthday parties as a kid where there was a coin in the cake and you had to find it. If you did, you were the winner. Like, yeah, that happened.
As long as it's a really big goddamn coin and not like a nickel, then you're fine.
Or a dime. Dimes are the smallest.
Dimes are bad, but, you know, quarters bad. But like a silver round, you know, a 1 ounce silver round would be pretty good. Or like a silver dollar, the old canoe silver dollars, Voyager silver dollars. Anyway, so you can't do this in the United States. You can only do it in Canada legally. I think it's fine to do it, you know, if you're going to pickle your own eggs, you can put stuff in there, but you can't sell it.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
Okay. So when I say it's illegal in the United States, it's illegal to sell what I'm doing.
Sure.
If I were to sell these pickled eggs.
Luckily, you're not selling anything, though.
I would never sell these pickled eggs. They're too delightful. So I'm going to eat a pickled egg. Here.
He's reaching into the jar.
Reaching into the jar. And I'm going to eat this egg here. Get your careful here, hold on. All right, excuse me. All right, so, okay, we'll just open this up. Oh, that was a really good pickled egg. It could use another 6 weeks.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, so, okay, unroll the paper here. Got the.
I hope the vinegar didn't, I don't know, wear the ink off the paper.
No, it was in the capsule, like there's little plastic capsules.
Got it, good.
Yeah, so, okay. So the name I got on here is Jamie R.
Okay. So all that, thank you very much, Jason, for that. And congratulations to Jamie R. for being this week's prize recipient in the Patreon Prize-a-Palooza.
Yep.
Jamie, I will be in touch by email to figure out how to get the prize out to you. So watch out for that. And I usually wait at least a few days before emailing people because I think it's more fun for them to hear their name like as a surprise on the show. Like if I email them tonight or tomorrow, they might not have had a chance to listen to it yet. So anyways, I will reach out and congratulations, Jamie. Next week's prize, Jason, is a good one. It is a Lucille baseball cap. So it's a black and red baseball cap with like the script Lucille across the front, which is of course the name of Negan's wife and barbed wire wrapped baseball bat.
Mm-hmm. Which we saw at the beginning of this episode.
We saw it in the flashbacks.
In the flashbacks, yeah, killing Abraham.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So a hat with that, with Lucille's logo on it, basically.
Lucky.
That's coming up next week. If you want to get in on the action and have a, you know, the possibility of winning that or any one of the future upcoming episode prizes, visit patreon.com/thetalkingdead and support the show. Thank you so much to everyone that does. It has been so much fun giving away this stuff. And we just appreciate every single person that signs up as a patron. And of course, everyone who listens too. So thank you to everybody. All right. That is it for this one. Feedback show will be coming later this week on Friday. So get your feedback in, your emails and your calls. If you would like to record a voice message, visit talkingdeadpodcast.com and click on send voicemail at the top to record that message. Or, you know, just record it into the voice memo app on your phone or however you can record some audio and then send us the audio file. That usually results in a really good sounding file. To send email, send them all to talkingdeadpodcast@gmail.com. And I will go through and read every one and include as many on the feedback show as possible. You can also find us on Twitter at Talking Dead if you want to call us out publicly for anything. or just say hi. That would be great, too.
Yeah, just say hi. And just remember that I did turn down the idiot knob, so... You know, you can still reach out. If I need to adjust that further, I will.
Absolutely. All right. Very, very good. All right. That's it, everyone, for this week. Until next time, my name is Chris.
My name is Jason.
Thanks for listening.
Ciao.